Welcome to the Insane Asylum.
And welcome back to the Insane Asylum. This is the Night of Living Dreads podcast. Podcast covers all and anything horror. I'm one of your hosts, so to speak, Dreads. Of course, I have, as always, Mrs. Dreads here. How are you, Mrs. Dreads?
I am good.
Awesome. We got a good show tonight.
I think so.
We really do. We have our first call-in guest. That's going to be the second half. The first half, we're going to talk some serial killer stuff. But, of course, before we do that, we got to give out some horror love. Gorehounds of Horror on Facebook. Best damn horror group on Facebook. Go check them out. 10,000 strong over there. And a close second, Misfit Horror Fiend Club. They're 1,000 and growing. They have really grown quite a bit. I don't know if you've noticed, Mrs. Dreads, but it seemed like, I mean, I don't think they've, you know, really been around all that much, but they are growing. The Slaughterhouse. Slaughter on Wayne.
Slaughter on Garth.
You hate doing that, don't you? You think it's so dumb. I think it's actually pretty funny. And I came up with it, just spur of the moment type thing. Slaughterhouse on Facebook. After Dark. Weird things happen after dark, like watch parties.
Yep.
So check them out. Am I missing any? Because zombie boob.
Yep.
How could I forget the boob?
I mean,
I didn't forget it technically. I mean, I'm going to have to start writing these down because there's a lot of horror groups out there that we are friends with, that we are helping to, you know, promote in our way, and they're giving us the space on their page or group to promote Night of the Living Dreads.
Yep.
So that's awesome. Zombie Boob, again, it's a very catchy name.
Catchy.
I don't know why. Are you scared? We went through this before.
Yeah, we've already talked about this.
Yeah, I like zombie boobs, but anyway.
You like boobs, period.
I like boobs, period. I'm a boob guy. All right. Boy, this is digressing quick. we also... our non-horror love, Cannabis Arcade, cannabis spelled with a K. And, of course, yours truly, Night of Living Dreads. We're over there on Facebook, nightoflivingdreads.com.
And Stitcher.
And we are on Stitcher. Yes, we are. You can check us out. Listen to the podcast on Stitcher. You don't even have to, you know, have a, you don't have to, I don't know, sign up or anything. You can just go to the link that will be accompanying this podcast, and you can listen. You don't have to be, you know, all into the Stitcher thing. You can just listen.
Yep.
So very excited about that, and I'm really excited about the show tonight.
It's gonna be a good show.
Who are we talking about tonight, Mrs. Dreads?
Dean, is it Coral?
Coral,
Corll. Yep.
This guy,
AKA Candyman.
The Candyman.
Pied Piper.
Which, you know, I heard that it, you know, really has no affiliation or anything with
Candyman,
the movie. Right?
Right.
Okay.
No, that was off of a short story.
Yes, yes. By Clive Barker, I
believe. Yes.
But yes, Dean Arnold Coral, born December 24th. He's born on fucking Christmas Eve. 1939 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's just a neighboring state of ours.
Yep.
They must be breeding them out there quite well. He died August 8th, 1973 at age 33 in Pasadena, Texas. He was, as you mentioned, named the Candyman and the Pied Piper.
Right.
See, it's creepy. Once we get into the story and you hear the name, the Pied Piper and Candyman, there are jokes, and it's also creepy. I think he came up with the creepy Chester the child molester van, you want some candy little girl scenario.
Probably.
I really do. And we'll get into that. His parents were Arnold Edwin Coral and his mother Mary Emma Robinson. So, let's get into a little bit about Dean.
Right.
Now, I'm from, I guess you could say, a broken home. My parents divorced.
Mm-hmm, mine too.
Yeah, and yours as well, right. Now, that can be kind of hard on a child a little bit.
Right.
I guess depending the age, if you remember it and blah, blah, blah. Dean's parents did that twice. Yeah. They divorced once in 1946, which would have made Dean about 7 years old.
Right.
And then reconciled things, you know, there, you know, the next year or so. Got married again and then divorced in 1953.
I just don't understand what you didn't figure out the first time.
Exactly. You know, I never understood, you know, I guess I can understand if you divorce, you know, reconcile to the point where if there's kids involved, you're good with that. But if the marriage didn't work the first time, 9 times out of 10, if a lot of things haven't changed, it's not going to work the second time. He had a brother named Stanley. Don't really know much about him. Don't really care. He's not the focus point of this podcast.
Right.
It said that Dean was actually a fairly normal little boy.
Right.
He was real quiet. He loved to play the trombone. He played it, I think, in a marching band. I didn't catch whether or not it was a school marching band or what. But, I mean, just a very normal kid. He didn't come from the best household, you know, given there. I think there was a lot of fighting going on
between the parents.
Right, between the parents. So that didn't work very well for little Dean. He dated. I mean, there wasn't an issue with him dating or anything. I believe it was after his mother, Mary. Oh, no, was that a religious thing? Mother Mary. See what
oh
I did
my
there?
God.
Yeah. I believe it was after his mother divorced his father for the second time. She got involved with and they started the candy company. Is that right? Is that what you have in your notes? At some point after the second divorce, the candy company was started.
Right.
The Coral Candy Company. And it was a factory. I mean, they made candy, mm-hmm. I believe, on site, and they had a store, and they sold it, you know,
right.
they're locally. And where we're talking about is Texas, Houston Heights area.
Right.
And so Coral, Dean, I should say, as a young boy in school, would work a lot of hours helping his mom, you know, run this. They said he would work day and night sometimes. And I guess, I don't know if he had a whole lot of friends. He was considered a loner.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess
probably
with
not
that,
tons of them.
Probably not a whole lot, right. Skipping ahead, though, in 1964, he was drafted in the Army. And he worked in the Army as a radio repairman. Unblemished record. He didn't have any problems in the Army, although right. he did ask for a discharge so he could help the family business.
Right.
It's also said that it was around that time in the Army he experimented with homosexuality and had his first homosexual experience
right.
in the Army. I know there's got to be a joke there.
I can't think of any jokes.
So, he only served about 10 months of service. Now, if I'm going too fast for you, Mrs. Dredge, please jump
in. No, you're good.
Okay. Please jump in with anything that you have. I mean, you got your notes. I got mine. After, right around 1968, his mom left the Houston area.
Right.
And went to Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would make, what, him about 29? He was born in 39. This was 68. He's about 29. So he pretty much took over the candy company. Now, this is where things start getting a little hairy. After he gets a hold of this candy company, this is when it said that he starts handing out free candy.
Right.
To little kids. Where was this candy store located, Mrs. Dredge?
Across the street from the elementary school.
location.
That's pretty
convenient for him. I mean, if you're,
brilliant place to put a candy store.
I mean, I get it from a business aspect, yes. But when you have a sociopath pedophile running a candy store,
may not be the
perfect location, but they didn't know that at the time.
No, because most people thought he was a great guy.
They did. They thought he was just doing a good service to the kids. He was being friendly with the kids. Nobody's seen him
as... Yeah, because he was friendly to neighbors. And
yes. Yeah, I mean, nobody's seen him as a threat. This is right around the time he met one of our players in this whole crime spree, one David Owen Brooks. Now, he had, it said, a secret affair with him. I don't want to give too much away, but I'm guessing Brooks was roughly about 14, 15 years old at this time.
Yeah.
I'd have to do the math, but yeah. I think they, Brooks later on around 73, Brooks and who we'll meet here soon, Wayne Henley. They were about 17, 18, around 73.
Right.
This was about 68. So, right around, maybe even younger. But anyway, he was having a little affair with him.
Right.
And he was using Brooks. This is kind of when it started. And he was using Brooks as a decoy to bring some of his friends over.
Mm-hmm.
Some of just teens in period. Bring them back, let's party, let's do this, let's do that. Mm-hmm. This guy will let, he's an older guy, he'll let us party in his house, man. We don't have to worry about it. Very enticing, I guess. Hey, it would have got me, hook, line, and sinker. Hey, free drugs, free booze, come on. But I don't think that Brooks knew what was going on at the time until Brooks actually walked in on some abuse going on.
Right.
And I don't know what your note says, but I heard Brooks kind of bribed Dean. Like, I won't say anything, but, you're going to have to give me, a place to stay and, maybe some wheels or something. There was a bribe going on there. That's how Brooks became an accomplice.
Right.
And in this whole time, as we see with a lot of serial killers, Dean had a girlfriend who was a single mother. Her name was Betty. Her kids called him dad.
Right.
He had a heterosexual relationship with her. Meanwhile, fondling and doing whatever, to teenage boys.
He was doing more than fondle them.
He really was. And had no record, as we mentioned.
He was squeaky clean.
Squeaky clean. Wee, wee, wee.
Oh, good God.
Oh, good God. Considered a model citizen.
Right.
And
that's how he got the nickname the Candyman, was because he would give candy to the neighborhood kids.
And it didn't even have to be Halloween. Right. So... And here we go, the stereotypical pedophile in a van. He drove a Ford Econoline van.
Right. I wonder if it was white.
I think it was. If it was the van that I saw, it was a white van. He would use this van to transport kids back to his place and then use that same van to transport their bodies somewhere else.
Right.
To their burial grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to get into what he did. We already know that David Brooks, and I guess we should mention Elmer Wayne Henley, who was actually friends with Brooks.
Right.
Kind of recruited him into this whole crime spree.
Right.
They were both accomplices. They both helped him get, you know, lure, which is where they got the name, I guess, the Pied Piper. Right. And they bring, so now we have Dean and his two accomplices.
Right.
Brooks and Henley. It became almost like a business.
Right.
And why would that be?
Because he was paying them, what, $200? $200. For each kid?
Yeah. So I'm assuming it wasn't $200 for Henley and $200 for Brooks.
Right.
I'm assuming they got the split $100, and this is early 70s. Yeah.
Decent money.
It's a lot of money for, you know, 15, 16-year-old kid.
And they say that they were doing it under the guise that he was sending them kids to a white enslavement camp.
In Dallas,
they were going to get tortured there, that he didn't have anything to do with that part, that he was just getting rid of these kids.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Henley and Brooks found out different.
Right.
Because a lot of these kids in this area, and I guess we should preface this, the Houston Heights area at that time was kind of low income.
Yeah, because it was in an economic downfall.
Yeah, there wasn't good things going on in the economy in Houston Heights at that time. And there was a lot of reported runaways.
Right.
There was a lot of broken homes. Of course, you can just imagine how a bad economy and low income, how that affects, you know, parents, how that affects the kids. A lot of these teenagers were, well, running away. So that was kind of a disguise for Dean. The police didn't, you know,
suspect anything.
Right, go ahead.
But, I mean, there were families that were asking questions, because not all these kids that were being taken and brought back weren't bad kids.
Right.
I mean, you have the one family, the Hillgeists.
Yes.
Who, their son David and his friend, I think it's Mally Winkle. What a name. But anyway.
Mally Winkle.
They left. They went on a bike ride and just never came back.
Right.
And stuff. And they weren't bad kids.
Yeah, they didn't come from probably a bad family. They had no reason to run away.
Right. There's two sets of brothers that disappeared.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of these families were asking questions. They just didn't know where to ask, because they didn't know for sure what was really going on.
Like you mentioned, the police were not really taking this serious.
Right.
Because there was an abundance of teen runaways at that time. So a lot of times the disappearance and unfortunate murder of what is said to be upwards to 28 to 30 plus.
Right.
Only most of them were, you know,
I mean, he would make them write letters or call home just to
touch
base with their families to make it look like that they had left on their own.
Right.
That he didn't have anything to do with them leaving.
One mother, glad you mentioned that, one mother, Mary Scott, 17-year-old son, Mark Scott, this was one of the people that, one of the kids that, I guess you call him a kid at 17.
Yeah.
He would force them, because they wouldn't do it on purpose, have them write a postcard. One postcard he wrote his mom, it said, quote, "How are you doing? I am in Austin for a couple of days. I found a good job. I'm making $3 an hour," end quote. And you mentioned a lot of parents were still kind of suspicious, because either their sons did not, They didn't fit the profile of a runaway. They had a, you know, good home. They were decent. This, you know, Mary was one of them.
Right.
But even in light of the parents expressing their worry and suspicions, the police were not.
No.
At this point.
Because anybody can say that their kids came from a good home.
Absolutely.
You don't know what's going on.
And of course, you know, I mean, given the time frame in this podcast, we can't go through all of them. There were numerous victims. But let's just look at this story in a whole. We have Dean, who And these murders and kidnappings only happened between 1970 and 1973.
Right.
It's only a three-year period that we're looking at here. And we're looking at, again, some say, you know, 28 to 30, give or take. We have no idea.
Right.
And the reason that we have no idea how many is because Dean was never apprehended.
Right.
There was a situation that happened on August 8th, 1973. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, Mrs. Dredge?
Wayne Henley decided to take two friends over. It'd be Tim Curley and Rhonda Williams. They were going from Houston to Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
And they had...
All under the pretext of just partying.
Yeah, Kroll lived in Pasadena.
Right.
So they were taking them to his house. Yeah, it was under the guise. Even Henley at this point was thinking that he was just taking them there to have a good time.
Little did they know, but Timothy Curley, that was the intended next victim.
Right. They had been doing what they call, what anybody calls huffing. I mean, paint.
Huffing paint.
Glue,
right.
Whatever. Smoking weed and stuff. They get to Kroll's house. They get drugged there also. Pass out. When they come to, they're all three bound. Curley and Rhonda were both, they had tape over their mouth. He went to do it to Henley, and he talked him out of it and told him that he would help him
mm-hmm.
with the other two victims.
Now, if I may say, Henley and Rhonda Williams
were dating.
They were kind of dating. They were good friends because the little story with Rhonda is her dad. What the reason that she came on this trip because her dad was drunk and beat her.
Right.
So she wanted to get away with some friends and go and party and blow off some steam until her dad sobered up and she felt safe enough to come back.
Right.
And Coral, he was absolutely against bringing
females.
A girl to the house, a female, period. So go ahead.
So when Henley showed up there, he was kind of pissy about that because of the fact. So, like I said, they woke up and they were all, Henley had talked Coral into letting him supposedly help him with taking care of the other two. Coral told him that Coral would rape
the boy.
Yeah.
He was going to go have fun with Curley.
And that Henley would rape Rhonda.
Mm-hmm.
Well, pretty much rape and kill him.
Mm-hmm.
So Henley made Rhonda be quiet because he didn't want Curl to let catch on that he was not going to do this.
Right.
Curl had a handgun that he used
in
some
caliber.
Of the other murders. Yeah. Somehow Henley got a hold of this gun and shot Curl 6 times.
Yes. They say he had gunshot wounds to the left chest area and the back.
Yep.
6 of them. Found him naked.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. I think after that, and this happened very early in the morning. I believe it was like 3 o'clock in the morning that all this was going down. They then proceeded to call the cops.
Yeah.
Henley
called and told him that he had just killed somebody.
Yes. And they came out and they see 3 very distraught teenagers sitting on the curb.
Mm-hmm.
And Henley, you know, admitted to this.
Right.
I think Henley was, in fact, doing it defensively.
I think it was too,
because he knew at the time that he wakes up from his drug induced whatever, he's waking up and he's bonded.
He's bound too,
just like the other one. So he knows that he is now a victim,
right?
But because of the past relationship that they had over the years, he was able to talk himself out of it.
Right.
So it's kind of like it's an act of, self-defense.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is after Henley had called the police, he decided to go into detail on stuff that had happened, like with the killings and stuff. And at first, the police didn't believe him. They thought that he was just over-exaggerating, happened.
And he was given names. He was given the order in which they were murdered, exactly where they were.
But after, that's when the police were were like, wow, he's really telling the truth about all this. Because, I mean, he was going into great detail on how these people, on how these kids died.
Yes. And, you know, one way that I don't know if we mentioned it, but one way that they would take and what would happen, they had a procedure board.
Yeah.
This was a 3x8 board that had holes in it that would have ropes and handcuffs attached to these ropes.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have, Coral was have his fun. And on a few occasions, Henley admitted to, you know, shooting these kids in the head. There was a kid, they found the corpse. His face was still contorted as if he was screaming in pain.
Right.
Very, very disturbing. I mean, I can kind of get a picture of that in my head, but I really don't want that image in my head.
Right.
So, you know, it's a very disturbing, you know, images that can come from this.
Right.
You know, again, it reminds me, you know, like, hey, little girl, you want some candy? In this case, it was, hey, teenage boy, you want some pot? Very, very, very creepy, this guy. So, but one point I want to make is that going back to the self-defense with when Henley shot Dean, it's strange, for one, that you have accomplices, and there's lots of serial killers out there who have accomplices.
Right.
But it's very rare that one of the accomplices turns on the person that's committing most of the heinous crimes.
Well, like he said, he knew he was next.
Yeah, he did.
He knew he was going to be a victim.
That's why I think it's more of a, you know, self-defense. But this kind of backfired on him. Because if you think about it, if Dean would have been arrested, and we talked about this earlier, Dean would have been seen as the primary assaulter.
Right.
You know, and Henley and Brooks would have been more victims and puppets on Dean's string.
Right. Because they're going to look at anybody once they confessed to what had been done. Well, once
Henley
confessed,
did,
because
yeah.
they never really say on whether Brooks, I mean, once he was apprehended, he confessed to it. But, I don't even know. I completely lost train of thought.
But, I mean, they in turn became killers just like Dean was.
Right. So that's what I was going to say, is that they have to have somebody to take the fall.
Sure. And they were unable. It says his criminal penalty is unimputable by death. They couldn't prosecute him. They couldn't do anything about his crimes. He took however many more deaths that were involved to his grave.
Yeah.
But Henley was not going to be a victim like what he helped in.
Right. And he confessed to it.
Yes.
He never once denied that he had any involvement.
And
with
here's the strange thing. When these kids started missing out of Houston Heights, parents would make flyers, put them on telephone poles. Henley did it too.
Yeah, because it was, there was so, one of
some
his
of
friends.
Them, yeah, some of them were his friends. And he was out there, you know, which is very strange. I mean, I don't know if he was involved in any of the killings, per se, at that time. Or involved in the abduction at that time.
Right.
Maybe he wasn't. I don't know. But he was out there. So, now here's an interesting fact before we take ourselves a short break. Two Chicago lawyers stated that looking at the crime spree of Dean, his methods, and such, that Gacy, John Wayne Gacy, was a copycat killer. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
He used a lot of the same methods. Gacy enticed boys or whatnot by being a clown.
Right.
Dean enticed them by candy.
Candy.
Or drugs later on to get the older, you know, teenage crowd.
Poor little Fez from that 70s show would never make it.
He would never. He'd be in every van. Free candy. He would. You've been watching a lot of that 70s show here lately.
Yeah, I like that 70s show.
Mother, I am not feeling well. All right, Mr. Dredge, we're going to take a quick break, and our break music goes right along with the second half of this show. We're going to play a little bit of Misfits' Hybrid Moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Night Living Dreads. Some hybrid moments. Mm-hmm. What'd you think about that, Jody?
It's a true Misfit song.
It really is. But, you know, I mean, and you've mentioned on other podcasts that you're more of a Misfits fan than you are, let's say, Danzig.
Yeah.
I agree. I love me some old Misfits. And it seemed appropriate for the second half of this here podcast. Because we have our very first call-in guest.
Yep.
And imagine this. We play a Misfit song, and it's almost like, you know, his ears were like radars. And, you know, he knew. Now, as you guys have always heard.
Oh, my God.
Oh, you be quiet there, Mrs. Dredds. As in the beginning of every episode, I give out some whore love. And, you know, one, of course, Gorehounds of Horror, another being Misfit Horror Fiend Club.
Yeah.
And I thought that it would be appropriate to have maybe the you know, founders, the creator of some of these groups that I talk so highly of to be on the show.
Right.
And it just so happens that I have both the creators and both founders. It's a husband and wife combo. Isn't that weird? Because Night of Living Dreads is now a husband-wife combo.
That's crazy.
And, I can tell by the look in your eyes. You are just dumbfounded with astonishment. But yes, we do. We have the founders of the Misfit Horror Fiend Club, Van and Trisha, are here with us. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. What's up, everybody?
Hey, we're doing good. Thanks for having us on, brother.
Hey, no problem, man. Thank you for joining us. We did get visits. The White Coats let us get a visit here in the Insane Asylum, which thanks to them, I guess, it was just why we are talking. Let's start right off, okay? You know, some people may know, of course, you guys have been, you know, very gracious to let us, you know, promote the podcast over there on Misfit Horror Fiend Club. And and it's going out to a lot of, you know, other places. You know, we're now on Stitcher. So why don't you guys take a moment and just tell people about Misfit Horror Fiend Club, what they can look forward to when they come there, because people will come. If you build it, they will come. yeah, just give us a little rundown on Misfit Horror Fiend Club, my friend.
Well, the thing behind it is I combined my two loves, which first off is Misfits. That is my favorite band.
Right.
And horror is my favorite genre of movies. Been a fan since I was very young.
Okay.
And decided to be different from everybody else and just decided to make this. And I can't believe it's done what it's done.
You guys are over you guys are over 1,000 members now?
Yes, and it's growing faster than that. Ever since we've hit 1,000, I mean, we've entered accepted almost 50 more requests.
Wow, that's awesome!
Within the past couple of days.
So
yeah, I am very happy.
So you know, Didn't you tell me at one time that you had a little issue with the name Misfits? Because the name of the band is The Misfits with an S on it.
Yeah,
you couldn't do it that way. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, actually my first group was The Misfits Horror Fiend Club. And it took about a month, but yeah, it got shut down for copyright.
Yeah. Well, which, you know, I get, but it seems a little bit out of the Misfits character. I mean, I don't think it was them so much as it was what, Facebook?
Right. Yeah.
So then you just take the S off of it, and now you got a group that is just growing, you know, like never before.
Yeah, beyond my expectations.
Awesome. And that's awesome. So whose idea was it really? What was it, you, Trisha? Was it your idea or was it Van's idea? Let's be honest here.
I can absolutely take no credit for this one. This is all him. This is his baby. And it keeps him out of my hair. So I support it 100%.
That's great. Typical wife response.
Right?
That's the same one I would have given.
Oh, hey, you... I'm muting her mic here in a minute. No, that's great. So this is Van's baby, and Van the man. I'm glad to see it doing as well as it is, and it can only grow from there. There's a lot of Misfits fans out there. There's a lot of horror fans out there. As a matter of fact, I just came across a stat stating that horror movies are actually leading all genres at this point as far as money being brought into the box office. Horror as at the top.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
This is a crazy summer, you know, for horror movies. There's a lot coming out. I'm not saying they're all good, but there's a lot coming out. Speaking of horror movies, though, you, what about a week or so ago, was just at the Crypticon. That's a convention for, what, horror and things of that nature. I have not been to one, but trust me and Mrs. Dredge are really trying, you know, to get the one that comes around here locally. You met some pretty important people in my book, some that I am extremely jealous. Tell us about your experience there at Crypticon.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. Who was the first person there?
Bill Mosley.
Oh, Bill Mosley. Awesome. Very, very, very awesome guy. He definitely met my expectations.
I've heard a lot of people that actually say when they meet Bill, he seems like such a down to earth guy, just a very, you know, nice, friendly guy. I've heard people say that before, and now I think I can firmly believe it. Coming from somebody that I'm talking to that has actually met him. That's what I've heard.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a very nice guy.
Yeah, no, he was very easy to talk to. Stood up. He took extra pictures with me. Shane was there to meet him, not me.
For free.
Yeah.
What the hell?
So, no, he was really awesome. I mean, you want to talk about the horror community and the money that is being brought in, that's where you see that at. It's an expensive day.
Oh, I'm sure it is at one of those events. And, you know, you're going to have a pocket full of change. But regardless, I think the experience of just standing next to Otis P. Driftwood,
yeah.
You know, I mean that right there pays for itself.
No, everybody we met, priceless, just priceless.
So you met Bill Moseley. Who else in the rundown that you met?
The awesome Sid Haig,
Captain Motherfucking Spaulding.
Yeah.
Yes, he was awesome. It was his 80th. Birthday
that day.
He had the longest line all day, and he did not move. He did not take a lunch break. He was the cheapest out of anybody to meet. Would take free pictures.
Awesome.
Just amazing. He was there for the fans. He was really, really an amazing experience.
Definitely.
That's beautiful. I mean, it really is, because you don't see that really a lot with, you know, big celebrities, you know, most of the time. And maybe that's just something that we make up in our mind that they're all hoity-toity, you know. But it is nice to, you know, meet somebody who has been in numerous films. And Sid has been in films going back to the 50s and 60s. And
yes.
So,
yes, back to Westerns, man.
Yes, Westerns.
I mean, he's been in Western films.
So Sid was good. So you got two people that were in, well, Devil's Rejects, and of course
most of their movies.
Most of his movies, House of a Thousand Corpses, and of course the new Three from Hell. Who else did you meet?
The great Kane Hodder.
Kane motherfucking Hodder.
Yes, and I can't even explain my experience with him. He was just awesome. We actually have a friend in common, and he made me take selfies with him to send to my friend.
That is awesome. So he pretty much had the same, you know, attitude as Bill and Sid did when you met them. Just a very down to earth guy, because he kind of appears that way to me.
Oh yes, he was very cool, very down to earth.
What other things do they have? Were they the only people that you met that day?
No, we actually met any fans of Sons of Anarchy.
Okay.
The great Ken Coates.
I've heard the name. Yes.
Yeah, we met him. Everybody there was awesome. We met lots of people. Actually, Heather Langenkamp from Nightmare on the Elm Street.
Oh.
She ran over my husband. She was in a hurry to go somewhere, and she just ran right into him. So that was fun.
That's hilarious, boy. That's something to tell the grandkids one day, right?
Right. Yeah, she just bumped into me and looked at me and said, "Sorry."
That's awesome. So it
was a great day. We had a great time. Everybody was so nice. And really, I mean, the parking, they opened up the parking for free. The tickets were cheap enough. They had food there. They had beer there. It was a great day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was, you know, partly part of my next question. You know, what all different kind of activities do they have there for any listeners that haven't had a chance to go to one of these events? And I'm one. What can someone expect other than, you know, meeting celebrities? I mean, yeah, I'm sure they got all kinds of different vendors. I mean, can you buy horror merch and things like that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they definitely had a ton of vendors. One floor was actually all vendors, which is pretty cool. They had cosplayers everywhere. They had a cosplay contest. Actually, one of my buddies was in that, at Jason from Jason X, I believe.
X, right.
Yeah. And let's see, they had Animal from the WWE.
The Road Warriors?
From back in the day. Yes, the Road Warriors. He was there.
Shut up.
Had a ring set up, and he was wrestling like Mexican wrestlers, you know, with their masks. Yeah, the masked wrestlers. And it was pretty cool. And it was loud, man. I mean, it was a legit ring and everything.
That would be great, man, because, you know, I was, as a kid, a big wrestling fan, and one of my favorite tag teams was the Road Warriors.
Yes, definitely.
So now, what kind of merch did you bring anything home, man? What kind of cool swag did you end up bringing home, or was? I mean, I'm sure it's probably pretty expensive.
Well, it wasn't that bad. I mean, I got Kane Hodder to sign my Part 7 Hawk.
Nice.
That was only $40 with, you know, and I got pictures with him.
Worth it.
I got Bill Mosley to sign my Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 VHS.
Awesome.
Which was already autographed by Bill Johnson, the guy who played Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Right.
So I've got both of their autographs on that now.
Did he?
Yeah, that's really how we spent our money. As far as the merchandise goes, I mean, they have everything from, like, stickers for your car and posters and T-shirts to, you know, more expensive, like, dolls and figurines and things. But we can order most of that stuff online. It's neat to go look at and see what you want.
Sure.
But we spend our money meeting people, taking the pictures, getting personal things signed.
And I agree, Trisha. That's probably what Mrs. Dreds and myself would do too. Spend the money, you know, to, you know, that way, you know, if I spend $40 for, you know, someone like a Kane Hodder to take and sign something and then get my picture with them, and that's all included in that $40. That was worth, you know, $400 to me, you know. I mean, if not more, it's
definitely
priceless, really.
Really? Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
Now, real quick, did Bill, when he signed your Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, did he sign it, Bill, or did he sign it, Chop Top?
He signed both, actually.
Oh, awesome.
He signed Bill Mosley on the front and Chop Top on the back.
That's great.
Yes. And actually, Bill Johnson did two different things, too.
Awesome.
So that was pretty cool.
All right. Now we're going to switch gears. Is there anything else you guys wanted to say about Crypticon? I mean, anything at all?
No, better than we'll go again next year.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm going to have to check one out. You know, we're here in the Midwest, down here in Ohio, where nothing happens. I think I'm the biggest.
We're in Kansas. We're in the Midwest. We may have to meet halfway in St. Joe and do this next year.
Hey, I'm down. I mean, you guys do have Dorothy.
That's funny. That's my wife's favorite movie.
Hey, it was mine too growing up. Who didn't love the Wizard of Oz growing up?
Right? I still do.
Yeah,
that was my horror movie as a kid. That witch is evil. She scared the shit out of me.
That shit scared me too. I'm not even going to lie. She was just kind of creepy. And you got these little flying monkeys, them little, you know, beasts, them little bastards flying around picking people up. No, that scared the shit out of me too.
Absolutely. So, yes. Well, we may have to make plans for that. Really, it's not too much money.
Awesome.
The town was great. The tickets are cheap. The parking was free. The hotel was cheap. It was awesome. Awesome experience. Everybody should go to a Crypticon.
I agree, and I haven't been yet, but I'm already, you know, seeing myself at one. So, you know, the Wizard of Oz scaring the shit out of you, Trisha, and myself. And Van, did you say it scared you?
Hell no.
Oh.
Nothing scares me. Nothing.
So, all right. I'm going to ask both of you. I don't care which one goes first, but what movie turned you guys into a horror fan?
I'm going to say the Friday the 13th franchise.
Okay.
My mom took me to, as a, you know, Friday the 13th, Part 6 was the first one I saw in theaters. and then she took me to see 7, 8, 9. So yeah.
And how,
my mom was.
I don't want you to, you know, have to put your age out there, but I mean, what was this? Was this a young van? When you first saw it, yeah.
Yeah, actually, I think my first actual horror movie I went and seen in theaters, my aunt took me to, was April Fool's Day.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Do you remember that movie?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that's an 80s slasher there.
Yeah, I was probably, 7 or 8. I don't remember. I don't recall, but I was young.
And very intrigued.
I thought that movie was hilarious.
You thought that movie was funny?
Yeah, it was a funny movie. What an airy.
Trisha, what was the one movie that turned you into a horror fan, dear?
Well, it wasn't a movie. It was Van.
Oh,
it was Van the man.
Okay.
Yes, he's the man. I was never allowed to watch horror movies. And for our first date, he took me to see Halloween H2O in the theater. This was the third time he had seen it in the theater, so he knew all the parts to, like, reach out and scare me with, which was just, you know, the attempt to fill me up. So I guess that's where that all started, just with him.
Wow. So, I mean, was this, H2O, I know, you know, about when that came out, so I guess you guys were, you know, what, just dating? This was a date or something, and... He takes you to a horror movie.
This was our very first date.
Awesome.
Our very first date. I think I was 17.
That's awesome. And you're just scaring the shit out of her the whole time, man.
Yes, he did. That's how he flirts. He thinks it's cute.
Oh, well, I get it. That's how I flirt, too. That and physical pain.
We're just
disgusting. We'll get into
shit.
The bondage stuff on the next interview.
That's for another show, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, now as kids, did any movies really give you any nightmares? Was there a movie that just grabbed you so much? Maybe it was a scene in the movie, maybe, you know, whatever. You know, did any movie as a kid now? So we got to go back. We'll say, you know, preteen. That scared the shit out of you, that maybe gave you nightmares, just made you feel uneasy for any length of time.
I forgot about Jaws.
Jaws would be it for me, too, because that was, again, the only horror movie, quote, horror movie I was allowed to watch. I still have a recurring nightmare about swimming in the pool and Jaws coming up to get me. So that's it for me.
And you...
I forgot about...
Go ahead, Vannon.
My mom took me to see Jaws 3D, too. I forgot about that one. That scared the shit out of me, 3D glasses.
Oh, yeah. You know what? You know what's funny? I can remember, you know, because I think the first Jaws came out in, what, like 77 or something? Like late
77 or 78.
Yeah, late 70s, so... And, you know, so I saw it, and I guess I am putting my age out there because, you know, I was about, you know, 6, 7 maybe. And, I could have been about 5 or 6, to be honest. My math was off there. But that literally scared the hell out of me because, you know, as a kid, I used to go out to the Eastern Shore. I lived out in Maryland, and we go to a place called Ocean City. And, you know, just a big, just a big beach. And here, before Jaws, before I saw Jaws, it was jellyfish you had to worry about. Jaws was a bigger fucking problem. And I'm constantly, I had such a hard time going in there. I'm like, what just touched my feet? What just touched my leg? You know, is that Jaws? I don't hear the fucking music. How am I supposed to know? You know, one of those kind of things.
Right? That's funny.
So, Joel's kind of freaked me out as well. All right, here we go. Now, Van, I hope you have your Misfits thinking cap on, because this is something that I could have told you in the process of putting this little interview together, but I chose not to.
Right.
We're going to do a little Misfits kind of one Misfits trivia question. Okay. Actually, there's going to be a couple involved here, but the first one, I have a list of about 10 movies that are said to have influenced the Misfits. How many of them can you name?
Let's see. The Crimson Ghost.
Okay.
Were Eagles Dare?
That's not on my list, but and I've actually never heard of that movie, but okay, I'll take your word for it.
I could be wrong on that. But I'm pretty sure. The Crawling Eye.
That is also not on my list, but not saying that just because it's not on the list here, that it's wrong. This... I'm learning new ones. I should be jotting these down.
Die, Die, My Darling?
Yes, I have that one down on my list.
Man. That was a good question.
Yeah, it was.
Now, I'll give you a clue on some of the movies. I'm looking at five of these movie titles actually are the titles of Misfit songs.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember them.
And one should be really easy. I mean, you have to go back to the 60s, but... See, I got him. I got him. I got him.
Yeah, you got me.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot there, man. Yes, actually, yes, okay. I did. Yeah, I did. I'm lying. All right, here, I'll give you one. Let's just go with the Marilyn Monroe movie from 1961 called The Misfits.
Yeah.
Okay.
How about that one?
The Astro Zombies from 1968.
Okay.
Blood Feast from 1963. And one of my favorite songs, The Brain Eaters from 1958. Then you have a nice little ditty called Green Hell. But there was a movie called The Monster from Green Hell, which came out in 1950. The original Hills Have Eyes is said to have some influence on any one of the band members or the band in whole. Horror Hotel, there's another one of their songs. Night of the Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead, yes.
Yes.
Return of Fly.
Return of the Fly. That was next on my list. You are reading my mind from 1959. Yes, sir. The Return of the Fly.
Night of the Ghouls.
Night of the Ghouls is another movie from 1957. See, now you're in the flow, my friend.
Yeah, we just had to get rolling on it.
All right. Well, now that you're rolling, do you know where... The I guess you could say the font design of their logo, okay? The Misfits. I'm not talking about the skull. I'm talking about the lettering of the words The Misfits. Do you know where that was taken from?
I'm trying to remember that.
Cue Jeopardy music.
I feel like we should offer him a prize.
I know, right?
I thought it was Die, 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 My Darling.
It actually is the exact design, lettering-wise. The font is the exact same as a magazine called The Monster Magazine.
Hmm.
Or The Monster is the name of the magazine. And if you look at that, you can see it's exactly... the same. The M is the same. Everything is the same. Now, you mentioned The Crimson Ghost, a movie from 1940, and that was actually where the, you know, skull came from.
Exact skull.
Yes, the exact one. You look at that skull in that movie, it's identical to what they use now.
Right.
Yeah.
So very cool, man. So you didn't do too bad, man, with this pop quiz.
I would have hung up.
We'll know the study next time.
Well, I won't. Maybe next time I won't have one. See, that's the whole purpose of a pop quiz. You don't know when it's coming.
Yeah, you just caught me off guard.
I know. Just like all the teachers, we cussed under our breath when we heard it. It's time for a pop quiz, kids. Hey, you can go fuck yourself, teacher. I was not ready. All right, Van, Tricia, I want to thank you guys for joining us, me and Mrs. Dredge here in the Insane Asylum. Give a shout out to Misfit Horror Fiend Club for me.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, brother, for having us on.
Hey, no worries, man. Misfit Horror Fiend Club on Facebook. That's going to do it for this episode of the Night of Living Dreads. Thank you, Van. Thank you, Tricia.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Otis. And
as always, thank you, Mr. Dreads. And we will see you on the other side.
Things no one knows. We're going to die.